5.
Burn it,
Tammy said. This was later in the evening, after Abigail was asleep and my sister was home from work. We sat at her kitchen table with two cups of decaf and the map unfolded between us. The wavy topographic lines seemed to pulse and vibrate if I stared at them too long, like the document was radioactive.
You can't keep it, Frankie. It's too dangerous, so you either burn it or you turn it over to the FBI. And I know you're not turning it over to the FBI.
I thought back to Linda and Brody Taggart and their tidy little home on Alpine Creek. I liked to tell myself that Aiden's death had brought the family some measure of peace and closure, but I hated that they never had the chance to recover their daughter's body and give her a proper burial. It could really mess me up if I dwelled too long on it. I'd have to stop and remind myself that Maggie's well-being was still my primary concern. So as soon as I got home, I went outside to my backyard and dumped a bag of charcoal briquettes into my hibachi grill. I soaked them in lighter fluid and struck a match, then waited until the coals were nice and hot before retrieving the map from my pocket. I wanted to make sure it was completely obliterated, that no forensic investigator would ever recover flecks of the thing from my grill, and just before I set the paper onto the flames, I wondered if I was throwing away an opportunity. Here was one last chance to show my daughter how much I trusted her, to show her how much I'd learned from the mistakes of my past. If anyone was ever going to need leverage against the Gardeners, it was Maggie, not me. I refolded the map and put it back in my pocket, and then I replaced the lid on the grill. By this point, it was nearly 11 o'clock, but I tried dialing Maggie anyway. I reached her at the penthouse apartment in Beacon Tower. She explained that she was still living there, that the Gardeners had encouraged her to stay as long as she liked.
What's going on?
She asked. Her voice was bright and cheerful, like we were the sort of father and daughter who talked every day, and maybe I just needed to run over to borrow a cup of sugar. I said that I needed to tell her something, in confidence, something that she could never pass along to Errol or Jerry or anyone else. Can I trust you to keep this between us?
What are you talking about?
You have to promise first. Please.
Fine. I promise. What is it?
Do you remember Abigail, Tammy's foster kid?
The one with the head lice? Sure.
She found something in her suitcase. Right before Aiden died, he left her a map of Lake Wyndham. And there's an X on it, marking a spot on the water. I think it's...
Wait.
Suddenly, she was very engaged in the conversation.
You need to back up. Why does Abigail have a map of Lake Wyndham?
So I had to explain the whole story, how Aiden inadvertently left the map in Abigail's suitcase instead of mine. He was trying to give me some protection, so I'd have leverage over the Gardeners.
And it's just been hanging in Abigail's bedroom, where anyone can see it?
It's fine, Maggie. She's still new here. She hasn't made a lot of friends yet.
What about social workers? Don't they visit the condo to check on her?
Trust me, I'm the only person who knows what it means. And I was going to burn it, just to get rid of it. But then I thought maybe you should have it, in case you ever need it. If you want to come home, I'll give it to you.
Well, I would really like to see it, but I'm flying to Madrid on Wednesday, and I'll be gone for 10 days.
I didn't want to sit on the map for 10 days. I suggested that maybe I just burn it after all.
Or what if you came to Boston?
She suggested.
Are you doing anything tomorrow? We could meet here. I'll see if Lucia's free to make something. You liked her cooking, remember?
6. I'd packed a small overnight bag with clothes and a toothbrush, but I didn't bother finding a hotel. I wasn't sure if I'd need one. I remembered that the penthouse apartment had a guest bedroom, and I hoped Maggie might invite me to stay over. Maybe we'd stay up the whole night, talking. Maybe we'd find a Waffle House in the morning and go out for pancakes. These were stupid thoughts. I know that now. There are no limits to how far parents will go to deceive themselves. It was late Tuesday afternoon when I crossed the Zakim Bridge and followed the familiar road back to Beacon Tower. This time, I simply left my Jeep in a vast employee parking lot, then crossed the street to enter the lobby. Once again, the beautiful Olivia was working the front desk, and she welcomed me back with a warm smile.
"It's wonderful to see you, Mr. Satowski," she said. "How was your drive?"
"Pretty good, Olivia. Thank you. Do you need to see my license?"
"Oh, no, sir. You're all set. Elevator D is right behind you. Enjoy your visit."
I entered the familiar black metal box without buttons, and once again the elevator seemed to move of its own free will. The small digital screen flickered to life and tallied the numbers of the passing floors. 2, 3, 5, 10, 20, 30, PH1, PH2, PH3. Then at last the doors parted, and I was back in the apartment. And Maggie was waiting for me, all dressed up in a shiny sleeveless gown and diamond earrings.
"Dad, you made it."
Her hair was longer and two shades darker than I remembered. She must have colored it since the wedding. She wore tall, spindly heels that lifted her face to my level. She greeted me with a gentle embrace, taking great care not to jostle my sling. I pulled her closer and assured her that my arm was already healed. The doctor was going to remove the cast at the end of the week, so she was free to hug me without the risk of breaking anything. The apartment had been redecorated. It still had the same floor plan with the same big windows overlooking the city skyline, but all the furniture was new, and the black and white paintings were gone. They'd been replaced by a couple of tasteful prints from Boston's Museum of Fine Arts, sailboats and flowers and vases, that sort of thing. "No more faces?" She laughed.
"Thank God, right? Those things always gave me the creeps."
She shivered at the recollection.
"I was glad to put them in storage."
I realized I was underdressed again. I'd worn a sweater and jeans because the bulky plaster cast made most other choices impossible. But Maggie looked like she was ready for the Academy Awards. "I didn't realize we were going out," I told her. "You said we would eat here."
"We are. You're totally fine. Everyone else is on the patio."
I followed her across the living room, and with the sinking feeling, I realized Errol Gardner and Jerry Levinson were waiting outside on the balcony, leaning against the railing with tumblers of bourbon. Maggie opened the sliding door and they greeted me with fake smiles.
"Frank Zatowski," Errol said. "How's the arm, my friend? We heard you took a real tumble."
I ignored him and turned to my daughter. "What are they doing here?"
"This concerns all of us, Dad. I think it's better if we work together. Just be transparent about everything."
I realized Hujo was there too, standing at the far end of the patio and pretending to ignore my arrival. He studied the skyline with a flat, neutral expression. And on one of the sofas, Sierra was slumped face down with her eyes closed, gently snoring. She'd kicked off her heels, and the hem of her dress was riding up, leaving parts of her thong exposed.
"What happened to her?" I asked.
"Too many cocktails," Jerry explained. With an affectionate smile, he reached for a blanket, shook it open, and carefully draped it across his wife's body.
"When you only weigh 98 pounds, you really have to pace yourself."
I couldn't resist turning to Errol and asking after his wife. "How's Catherine doing? Is she going to join us too?" He seemed disappointed with me, like I'd made a joke in poor taste.
"It's been a difficult year for her, Frank. She's lost her only son."
But instead of staying home to support her, you're here to see me. I'm flattered. Because I just didn't care anymore. Or as the young capacity employees might say, I had zero fucks to give. Errol didn't seem troubled by my sarcasm, but Juho tensed up, like he was just waiting for a signal to throw me off the balcony.
Frank, I came here to express my appreciation to you. The information you found has a lot of value to a lot of people, and I know you could have made a different choice.
I brought it for Maggie, not for you or anyone else. She's the only reason I'm here. The glass door slid open, and a smiling Lucia stepped outside, dressed in a white chef's coat, and I thought I recognized a flicker of sympathy in her eyes. I imagined that she'd overheard a lot of conversations while doing her invisible labors in the kitchen, that she was probably burdened with lots of ugly and unpleasant secrets. Maybe she'd always known the wedding was a farce, that my daughter had been lying to me from the start, because she seems to understand how much it hurt me to be there.
It's nice to see you again, Frank. Could I bring you something to drink? We have beer or cocktails or really anything you'd like.
Over on the sofa, Sierra flopped onto her side and her blanket slipped to the floor, exposing her thong and bare bottom to the entire city skyline. Lucia was unflappable and pretended not to notice. Thank you, Lucia, but I'm only staying for a minute. Just a quick hello, and then I'll be out of your hair. Maggie put up a small, polite protest.
Dad, are you sure? She's made her famous roast duck. It takes 72 hours to prepare, and it's out of this world.
I said I was very sorry to miss it, but insisted I needed to get back to Stroudsburg.
Some other time, Lucia promised.
And I think she knew the truth before I did. I was never coming back to the apartment. I would never sample Lucia's cooking again. I waited until she was inside with the door closed before reaching for the map and passing it to my daughter. Aiden called it protection. I think he was trying to give me some kind of leverage, but I'm never going to do anything with it, Maggie. I only want good things for you. So you might as well have it.
Thank you, Dad. I appreciate it.
My daughter studied the map before passing it to Errol and Jerry, and then they signaled for Juho to come take a look as well. They all seemed unafraid to handle it with their bare hands, and I understood why a moment later, when Errol brought it over to the fire pit and carefully fed the map to the flames. It took a moment to catch, and then with a flash, the fire engulfed it, reducing the paper to a few flecks of ash. Over on the sofa, Sierra rolled onto her back and softly whispered in her sleep.
Don't.
Errol gently clapped his hands together, suggesting the problem had been resolved.
Frank, are you sure we can't get you a drink? The traffic's crazy right now. You may as well stay for a beer.
I didn't want to stay any longer than necessary, and I really didn't want to say goodbye to Maggie in front of all these assholes, but she hadn't left me with any choice. 3 years ago, you asked for my help, and I let you down, and I've always felt bad about it, so I hope this makes up for it, Maggie. I only want the best for you. There were a million other thoughts going through my head, so many more things I wanted to say, but I realized there was only time to make one last point. If you ever get tired of all this, if you don't want to be here anymore, you can always come home. Anytime you need a place to stay, I'll be waiting for you.
I know, Dad. Thank you. Let me give you a hug.
She stepped forward and put her arms around me, and I sure hoped this wasn't the last time I'd ever see her. But I realized it might be. And I really couldn't make sense of it. Somewhere inside her was this kid who loved to read Goodnight, Gorilla. A kid who loved to play Hug Monster. A kid who loved strawberry pancakes with extra whipped cream. A sweet little girl who ran laughing through lawn sprinklers on hot summer days. I didn't know what had happened to that kid. I didn't know where I went wrong or how I screwed up, but I knew I would always love her, despite everything that came after. I broke away because I felt myself starting to cry, and I was not going to let Errol see that. Come on, Frankie. Keep it together. I said goodbye, and my voice was barely a whisper. I love you, Maggie. Be good, okay?
All right, Dad. Safe travels.
Then I turned and went for the patio door, and I heard Jerry clear his throat.
Frank, there's just one more thing, he said, reaching into his pocket for a small notebook. Where's the girl staying now?
The question hung in the air, and I was still too choked up to understand it. What girl?
Abigail Grimm, the girl who found the map.
She's with my sister. Hujo brought his tablet computer over to Jerry and showed him the screen.
And your sister's still at 18 Conover Road, Unit 106?
Yes, but why does it matter?
Jerry dismissed my question with a wave of his hand. Just checking.
Checking for what? I looked from Errol to Maggie. Neither was willing to answer my question. What's happening here? At which point Jerry finally spoke up.
Our understanding is that Aiden gave the map to Abigail. Possibly by mistake, as you suspect, or perhaps it was intentional. Maybe he wanted Abigail to have it. Maybe he shared other information with her. The truth is, we don't know. And that's a problem.
She's only 10 years old, I reminded them.
A very bright 10 years old, Jerry said, with an incredible memory for detail. Your sister thinks she should go on Jeopardy.
Little pitchers have big ears, Errol said. She probably heard all kinds of rumors that weekend.
Maggie reminded me that Abigail had even met Brody Taggart when we'd first arrived in New Hampshire.
Brody told you that Aiden killed Dawn Taggart and hid her body at the camp. Then 3 days later, Aiden gave Abigail a map of the camp with an X on it. Sooner or later, she's going to connect the dots.
And do what? She's in 5th grade. She sleeps with stuffed animals. Errol spoke in a calm, level voice that suggested everything would be fine.
We're just trying to stay ahead of the situation, Frank. The bottom line is, you're family, and we trust you. We know you want the best for Margaret, and we trust Tammy for the same reason. But the girl is a wild card, an unknown variable. She'll piece together the puzzle, eventually. And one day, when she's grown up and homeless and pregnant and addicted to drugs, she might try to trade on this information. So our challenge is, how do we prevent that from happening?
As Errol explained all this, I noticed Hujo typing a message into his phone. What are you doing? He ignored me until he'd finished typing the message and sent it off.
You needn't concern yourself, Mr. Zatowski. You've already done the most important thing, which was bringing the problem to our attention. We can take care of the rest.
Over on the sofa, Sierra awakened from her nap, sat up and smacked her lips together. She looked like she'd accidentally swallowed a bug.
Sorry,
she murmured, before looking down at her legs and tugging her dress to a more modest length.
No need to apologize, Jerry assured her. You're just sleepy.
She pinched 2 fingers between her lips and then carefully extracted a long length of hair, then studied it through bleary eyes.
This is definitely not one of mine.
Then she walked unsteadily to the edge of the balcony, tossed the hair over the railing. and watched the wind carry it away. Everyone seemed unconcerned, like this behavior was all perfectly normal.
Maggie, I need you to translate this conversation. What are we actually talking about?
She said a translation wasn't necessary.
I think you understand the conversation perfectly.
And you're okay with it?
I'm not happy about it. None of us want this to happen, but I understand why it needs to happen.
And I suppose that's when I knew I'd completely lost her. Up until that point, I'd been willing to rationalize just about anything. But this? It was so monstrous, so barbaric, so immoral and evil.
There's a silver lining we can all feel good about, Jerry continued. Next week, the Capacity Cares Foundation will make a generous donation to foster care charities in Abigail's name. Enough money to fund 25 college scholarships for disadvantaged young women. That's 25 little Abigails getting a boost out of poverty toward a brighter future.
At some point, I stopped listening. I tried to imagine how it might happen. Every weekday, Abigail walked home from school through several busy intersections. There were multiple opportunities for a hit-and-run accident. Or maybe it would happen at the condo, an attempted burglary gone wrong, an accidental house fire, maybe some glitch with the toaster oven. Or maybe she would simply go missing. Maybe the police would discover her sweatshirt in the woods behind Tammy's condo.
Dad? Maggie snapped her fingers in front of my face. Did you hear what Jerry just said about the scholarships?
When would all this happen?
Jerry promised me I had nothing to worry about. By the time you get home, it will all be over.
He spoke with the confidence of an experienced attorney, assuring his nervous client that everything was going to be fine. The plan was already in motion. Everything had been decided before I'd arrived. I checked the urge to reach for my phone and call Tammy, call the police, call anyone.
Errol leaned closer to me, interlacing his fingers and studying my expression.
Frank, are you okay? Is there anything we need to talk about?
I forced myself to mirror his behavior. I knew I had to stay calm, to react in a way he would understand. Suddenly, I wished I had asked Lucia for a drink, just so I could be holding a glass, a prop, to draw attention away from my face.
I didn't want to bring her to the wedding, I reminded him. It was all Tammy's idea. I told her it was a mistake.
I remember, Errol said. As I recall, you seemed pretty unhappy about it.
Exactly. She never should have been there in the first place. So I don't really care how you handle the problem.
Errol relaxed.
That's good, Frank. That's very understanding of you.
But if you want me to be okay with it, I'm going to need 5,000 shares.
For a moment, I worried that I hadn't asked for enough, that my figure was too low to be convincing. But then Jerry started to object, saying I was in no position to make demands, and I realized I'd hit the bullseye.
You gave my sister 1,000 shares just for coming to the wedding, I reminded him. And I brought you the map tonight on good faith. I was happy to leave here with nothing. But if you want me to be okay with this last part, if you want me to live with it, I need 5,000 shares in a brokerage account by end of day tomorrow.
I turned to Maggie to finish making my case.
You know this is going to wreck your Aunt Tammy. She'll be devastated.
She'll be fine, Dad. There's a long line of kids waiting to take Abigail's place.
No, Maggie. They'll never trust her with another foster placement. They'll take away her license, and she'll never forgive herself. And I'll have to deal with the fallout. You know I will. Now tell them this is fair. My daughter showed the slightest hint of a smile, and then I recognized something in her expression that I hadn't seen in a long time. Respect. For the first time in years, I'd finally impressed her.
"I do think it's fair," she said, "but it's not my decision to make."
"You're damned right it's not," Jerry said. "I can handle this," Errol told him. 5,000 shares is a lot of money, Frank." He was looking into my eyes again, trying to measure the depths of my conviction, and I didn't dare look away. I didn't even blink. This was it, the moment of truth, and the best thing working in my favor was that Errol Gardner had never bothered to get to know me. So now I could pretend to be anyone. Finally, he reached for his bourbon and shrugged.
"I can't transfer that kind of stock overnight. There are certain precautions we take to avoid scrutiny. But give us 72 hours, and you'll have it. Fair enough?"
In other words, he believed me. But then, of course he believed me. To men like Errol Gardner, my response was perfectly rational. In his worldview, every relationship was transactional. And when you found yourself with the upper hand, it was natural to exploit your advantage for maximum gain. Cooperation was for chumps. Grace was for losers. 72 hours is fine, I said. He smiled.
"Well, I guess this dinner is going to cost a little more than I expected. Are you sure you won't stay and join us?"
I pointed out that I still had a long drive back to Stroudsburg and much to deal with upon my return. "But I will use the restroom before I go." Maggie offered to show me the way, but I told her I remembered how to find it. I left them on the balcony, crossed the living room and followed the short hallway past the powder room and the closets and all the way back to the master bathroom. The door was ajar. I went inside and locked it. Someone must have recently showered because there were traces of condensation on the mirror and wall tiles. I immediately reached for my phone and called my sister.
"Hey, Frankie, how's—"
"Tammy, listen. Abigail isn't safe."
"What?"
"Get her out of your condo, right now. Go to a hotel and don't tell anyone where you're going. Do you understand?"
"No, not at all. Why would I—"
"The map, Tammy. They know she saw the map. They're worried she'll talk. Someone is coming to your condo right now." My sister called for Abigail, asking her to come downstairs and put on her sneakers.
"We need to take a ride, kiddo."
Suddenly, I could hear her bustling around her kitchen, gathering her wallet, keys, and coat.
"This is all my fault," she said in a low voice. "You were right, Frankie. I should have listened to you. What's going to happen?"
"Just get out," I told her. "I'll call you as soon as I can." She had more questions, but I didn't have time to explain. I ended the call and then reached for the lid of the toilet tank. It was awkward and clumsy work with just one hand. I used the front of my leg to keep the lid from sliding out of my grasp, then carefully knelt down and set it on the tiled floor. The black plastic pouch was still duct-taped to the bottom, and I opened the medicine cabinet in search of something sharp, hoping for scissors and settling for pointy tweezers. I scraped at the plastic until it ripped and then used a finger to gouge it open. Inside was a narrow metal box about the size and shape of my checkbook, one of those things people use to back up the data on their computers. My first night in the apartment, I'd suspected Aiden was hiding secrets from my daughter. But on Maggie's wedding day, she'd made a confession to me. She said she'd recorded hours of conversation with the Gardners, Errol, Catherine, Aiden, even Jerry.
"If they ever try something, I'll bring them all down with me."
All this time, the person hiding secrets in the apartment was Maggie, and I was taking her secrets with me. I put the box in my pocket, then turned my attention back to the porcelain lid. I was tempted to rip off the rest of the plastic and duct tape to eliminate every last trace of the thing. But it was clumsy, difficult work with one hand, and there wasn't enough time. I needed to hurry, so I lifted the lid with my good hand, and in my rush to stand up, I felt wet porcelain slip through my fingers. It hit the floor and shattered into pieces. I froze, too scared to move, and waited for footsteps to come rushing down the hallway, for the sounds of Maggie or Hoo-Ho or anyone hurrying to inquire about the crash. Surely they all had heard it. Unless they were still outside, on the balcony, surrounded by the noise of the city. After a few more seconds of silence, I allowed myself to think that maybe I would be okay, as long as I left immediately. Cleaning the mess was impossible. There was simply too much of it, too many fragments and shards of porcelain, and a white powdery dust all over the floor. Instead, I just opened the bathroom door and found Sierra standing in the hallway, rubbing a knuckle into her eye.
"Do you got any saline?"
"I'm sorry?"
"For contacts. My lenses are so dry."
I opened the medicine cabinet and tried to direct her attention to the shelves, but she was already staring at the toilet tank and the mess on the floor.
"What happened?"
I found a bottle of Bausch & Lomb moisture drops and pushed it into her hand. "You should try these. I'll close the door to give you some privacy." I returned to the living room and found a smiling Maggie waiting at the door of the balcony.
"All set?"
"I think so." Errol and Jerry followed her inside the apartment, and Maggie pressed the call button for the elevator. The four of us made awkward chit-chat about late afternoon traffic, and Errol observed there was still a chance of beating the rush if I left soon. I listened for movement in the elevator shaft, for the sounds of motors or gears or pulleys, but I couldn't hear anything. I gave the button another little push, even though it was already lit up, and smiled at my daughter.
"Where's my wife?" Jerry asked.
"In the bathroom. She's having trouble with her contacts." As if on cue, Sierra emerged from the dark corridor, wobbling on high heels and bracing one hand on the wall to support herself.
"There she is," Errol said.
Somewhere down below, the elevator finally began its ascent, and soft mechanical sounds echoed up the shaft.
"My lenses are killing me," Sierra said. "I think I'm going to nap for a while." "Take the guest room," Maggie offered. "The bed's all made up."
Sierra nodded.
"I think I will. Thank you."
She was turning to leave, ready to retreat down the hallway toward the back of the apartment, when she added a final thought.
"Also, your dad broke your toilet."
Maggie, Errol, and Jerry all turned to study me. And I laughed, trying to suggest this was just another one of Sierra's bizarre proclamations.
"Someone definitely needs a nap."
Sierra must have been more clear-headed than I realized, because she narrowed her eyes and scowled.
"I'm serious, Margaret. Don't blame me for the mess, because I didn't do it. He did. You see the dust on his clothes?"
Maggie looked at my pants. Across my knees was a dusting of white powder that looked like confectioner's sugar.
"Dad? What is she talking about?"
The elevator was still squealing and churning and groaning, and still the doors did not open.
"Did you do something to the toilet?"
Even after everything that had happened, I still couldn't bring myself to lie to her. Errol or Jerry, sure. But not Maggie. The most important thing we can give our kids is the truth. She must have seen it in my eyes, because she turned and hurried down the hall to investigate.
"Maggie, come on," I called. "I'm leaving."
But still the elevator doors wouldn't open. Errol observed that they were always busy around 5 o'clock, because it's when employees on the lower levels began leaving for the day.
"The parking lot is going to be a zoo."
"If I ever get down there," I joked, while Sierra glowered at me from across the living room. She was sitting on the sofa and waiting for Maggie to return, convinced she would be vindicated. With a gentle ding, the elevator doors finally opened, just as Maggie called me from the depths of the apartment.
Dad, wait! Stop!
I pretended not to hear her. Good night, gentlemen.
Don't let him leave!
And I don't know where he came from, or how he moved so quickly, but suddenly Hugo was standing between me and the elevator.
Mr. Zatowski, your daughter's calling. Don't you hear?
Maggie rushed into the living room, and her eyes were mad with panic.
Give it back!
Errol was confused.
Give what back?
I realized I had put her in an impossible position. She couldn't ask for the recordings without admitting that the recordings existed, without admitting that she'd been secretly recording Errol and Jerry without their knowledge.
He took something from me, a hard drive with personal information.
She looked to my waist and she could see the outline of the metal box through my pants.
And now it's in his pocket. And he broke your toilet,
Sierra crowed.
I told you so, but none of you listened because nobody takes me seriously.
She tipped back her head and closed her eyes.
So now you can all go fuck yourselves.
Hugo released his hold on the elevator, and my heart sank as the doors slid closed. He said,
You can take the next one, Mr. Zatowski. Can you empty your pockets, please?
I realized that all my hard-earned situational awareness skills had failed me, and I'd stupidly allowed myself to be trapped. Jerry stood to my left, Errol and Maggie were on my right, and Hugo stood in front of me, waiting for me to comply with his instructions. He'd reached inside his coat for a small black pistol, but held the weapon casually at his side, simply making its presence known. An unnecessary gesture, in my opinion. I knew he could overpower me, even without a weapon. I still remembered how he pinned me to the wall of the fallout shelter and forced me to listen to Aiden's last breaths. I reached into my pocket and removed the hard drive.
That's it, Maggie said.
She went to grab it, but Hugo ordered her back.
Very slowly now. I want you to hand it to Mr. Gardner, he told me. Then we'll all find a computer, and together we'll see what's on it.
But I couldn't bring myself to turn it over. I knew this tiny metal box was my only hope of keeping Abigail safe. As long as I had their secrets, they wouldn't dare come after her. Hugo raised his gun, pointing it now, encouraging me to follow his instructions.
Don't be stupid, Errol told me. Whatever you're thinking, you're not smart enough to.
He was interrupted by a shriek. Lucia had emerged from the kitchen with an enormous platter of roast duck, but at the sight of the gun, she'd screamed. The serving dish hit the floor with a spectacular crash, and I swung at Hugo with my right arm, connecting my thick plaster cast with the front of his face and mashing his nose like a ripe red strawberry. He dropped his gun and stumbled backward, clutching hands to his face as blood spurted between his fingers. I hesitated only long enough to exchange glances with Lucia, and I swear that woman knew exactly what she was doing, sacrificing her exquisite 72-hour meal to give me a chance. I ran down the hall, past closet doors and the powder room and the door to the master bedroom. I knew enough about fire codes to know there had to be a second way out of the apartment, and since there were no exits in the kitchen or living room, it had to be the door at the far end of the hall, the one with the metal crash bar across its center. I slammed through it and found myself at the top of a wide concrete stairwell. The letters PH3 were stenciled onto the wall next to a simple fire alarm T-bar. I pulled the lever, and the alarm was instantaneous, an ear-splitting klaxon in a concrete echo chamber. I ran down to the alarm on PH2 and pulled that lever, too. By the time I made it to the 40th floor, the building's employees were already filing into the stairwell, while pulling on their jackets and complaining about another pointless fire drill. I pushed past them, trying to descend as quickly as possible, but feeling safer with every step. We weren't in Osprey Cove anymore.
We were back in the real world, where actions had consequences, and I didn't think a wanted international fugitive like Juho would start firing blindly into a stairwell full of people. We all emerged into a lobby, crowded with employees and unhappy tenants. Poor Olivia at the front desk was surrounded by angry faces and ringing telephones. Through the exterior glass walls, I saw a fire engine approaching with two police cars, lights flashing and sirens blaring. There were streaks of fresh blood on my cast and sweater. I was suddenly aware of a dull, throbbing pain in my right forearm and wondered if it was broken again. I pushed through the lobby and exited to an even larger crowd of people waiting outside on the plaza, some 200 or 300 employees gathered in clusters for warmth and conversation. Some people were watching the upper floors for signs of smoke or fire. Many more were staring mindlessly into their phones. 3 firefighters in bright yellow coats rushed past me, their boots trampling up the plaza stairs. A 2nd fire truck was already pulling into the lot, lights flashing and sirens pealing, and over the din, I thought I heard Maggie calling for me.
Dad! Dad! Dad!
I might have imagined it. I wasn't sure. I didn't dare turn around to check. The sirens rang louder, and people clapped their hands over their ears, swelling toward the building to escape the deafening noise.
Dad! Dad! Dad!
I walked alone against the crowd, the only person actively moving toward the sirens, until my ears were numb and I couldn't hear her voice anymore. Don't turn around, Frankie. Keep walking and don't look back.
7. Supercuts closed at 9 o'clock. And I didn't make it back to Stroudsburg until 10:15. My gas gauge was well past empty, and my engine was running on vapors, but I'd been too scared to stop and fill up. I knew I didn't have a moment to waste. I pulled into the strip mall parking lot, left my Jeep in a loading zone, and ran past all the skateboarders in front of the Chipotle. There were a half dozen teenagers doing tricks and flips off the wheelchair ramp. The sign in front of Supercuts was flipped to closed, but thank God I could see Vicky through the window, pushing around a broom and sweeping up the hair clippings. She'd locked the door, so I rapped my knuckles on the glass to get her attention. Without glancing up, she called out, "We're closed." I knocked louder. "Vicky! It's Frank!" She paused for just a split second and then continued her sweeping, pretending this meant nothing to her.
"You'll have to come back in the morning. We have stylists on duty starting at 7:30.
"Vicky, please, I need to talk."
"Well, I can't imagine why. I'm just the person who cuts your hair."
"I didn't mean that. I'm sorry I said it. Can you please unlock this door?"
"And I can't have customers in the salon after closing. It's against corporate policy."
Now she was arranging the fashion magazines on the table in the reception area, carefully fanning the latest issues of Vogue and Elle and In Style for the next day's customers. Vicky was dressed in a black sweater with an orange jack-o'-lantern and letters spelling boo. Her salon was all decked out for Halloween with paper cutouts of skulls and bats and Frankensteins. "Maggie's done something terrible, Vicky. I didn't want to tell you, because I'm ashamed of it. But I didn't want to lie, so I've just been avoiding you. And now I'm really in trouble, and I need your help. I can't even go home right now. I'm not safe there. Can you please, please open this door?"
With all my shouting, I'd attracted the attention of the skateboarders. They'd interrupted their ollies and kickflips to eavesdrop on our conversation. A girl with a metal rod through her nose offered me the use of her phone, suggesting that I might want to call 911. I waved her off with a polite, "No, thank you." I didn't need the police just yet. I'd already called my sister from the highway, and she assured me that she and Abigail were safe inside a room at the Hampton Inn, waiting to hear from me about next steps.
"Vicky, please." I held up the hard drive so she could see it. "I want to play something for you, okay? On your computer.
And when you hear it, I think you'll understand why I've been so weird lately. It's going to answer all your questions. Now I had her attention. Vicky was a smart, inquisitive person. She'd once told me that all her favorite historical romances involved some kind of secret or mystery. She came over with a massive set of keys, unbolted the door, and opened it, just far enough to let me slip inside. Then she locked it, lowered the blinds over the windows, and twisted them closed.
"Our computer's 10 years old," she warned. "Last week it crashed, and we lost all our October appointments, so don't expect any miracles."
We moved behind the reception desk where customers checked in and paid for their haircuts. Vicky found a USB cord connected to the back of the computer tower, and I plugged it into the hard drive. A little window opened on the monitor, alerting us to the presence of a new device and asking us to wait. A tiny little hourglass spun around and around and around. Vicky was looking me over, and I realized I smelled awful. I was soaked with sweat after driving home in a mad panic, zigzagging through traffic at 80 miles an hour. I was tired and severely dehydrated, and there were tiny dry bloodstains on my sweater.
"Geez, Frank, what happened to you?"
I realized Vicky was focused on my hair. I told her I'd started going to the other supercuts, the one in Mount Pocono, and my new barber was a guy named Rooster, who learned to cut hair in prison.
"The way he layers, you're better off cutting it yourself," she said. "Just put a bowl over your head and snip off the edges."
At last, a file directory opened on the screen, and I saw the disk contained some 2 dozen items. None of them had coherent names, just scrambles of letters, numbers, dates, and times. But Vicky seemed to recognize an order in them.
"Which one are you looking for?"
"I don't know." She double-clicked on the first one, and a little audio player opened on the screen. The file was 8 minutes and 7 seconds, and as soon as it began to play, I recognized the voices in the conversation. "Aiden."
"So, how long are we thinking?"
"Maggie."
2 years.
"Aiden."
2 years?
"Jerry."
12 months should suffice.
"Aiden."
"That's still too long."
"Errol."
"What are you thinking?"
"Aiden."
30 days, like a Vegas wedding."
"Maggie."
"No one's going to believe 30 days.
"Aiden."
"Well, I can't do a full year. I'm sorry. I'd rather go to prison."
"Jerry."
"You won't be the only one going. Your decision has consequences for a lot of people."
"Errol."
"Son, this isn't what you're thinking. Maggie and I will spend most of the year traveling. Once or twice a month, you'll make a public appearance together. Otherwise, you'll be a free man."
"Aiden."
"Actually, I'll be a married man. Married to your girlfriend, Dad. Am I the only person who thinks that's fucked up?"
Wait, hang on. Vicky reached out and paused the recording.
"Who's marrying Dad's girlfriend? Is that Aiden?"
"Yes."
"Then who's the girlfriend?"
I hesitated just long enough for Vicky to put 2 and 2 together, and her eyes went wide. Then I clicked open the next file, anxious to hear another conversation. "Maggie."
"And then I called my father."
"Errol."
"And?"
"Maggie."
"It went okay. He was happy to hear from me, and he said he'd come to the wedding."
"Errol."
"Good. People will expect him to be there."
"Maggie."
"But he wants to come to Boston this Friday, meet his future son-in-law, and Aiden's being stubborn."
"Errol."
"Why?"
"Maggie."
"He says he already has plans."
"Errol."
"What kind of plans?"
"Maggie."
"I don't know. I tried to make it easy for him. I said we'd do it at the apartment, and I'd hire Lucia to cook. 2 or 3 hours tops. But he's giving me shit."
"Errol."
"Tell him it's essential."
"Maggie."
"He says it's more than we agreed to."
"Errol."
"Come here, beautiful. It's going to be fine. I'll have Hujo talk to him."
"Maggie."
What's Hu-Ho going to say?
Errol, don't worry about it. Just go ahead and plan your dinner. I guarantee Aiden will be there.
There was more after that, but I lost my focus. I started remembering my first visit to the apartment, remembering Aiden's late arrival and his general unhappiness at dinner, the way he'd seemed so reluctant to speak with me, and Maggie warning me not to ask about his bruises. Vicky hit the spacebar on the keyboard to pause the conversation. She'd been keeping silent, but she couldn't hold back anymore.
You gotta help me, Frank. I need some context here. What are these people talking about?
I'll tell you the whole story, I promised. But first, we need to call your son.
8. 7 months later, Abigail made her stage debut in her elementary school musical, Beauty and the Beast. She played a spoon, or rather, she played a castle servant who was magically transformed into a spoon. She had just one song and 10 minutes of stage time, but she'd been rehearsing for weeks, like she had the lead role. At 7 o'clock on opening night, the curtain went up, and I found myself backstage with a couple of other dads who volunteered to push around the heavy sets. I was surprised to find myself feeling nervous. I really wanted the show to be perfect. After a long week of rehearsals, I'd memorized the lyrics to every song, and I found myself whistling the melodies anytime I was stuck at a red light. Be our guest, be our guest. Your command is our request. Vicky and Tammy watched from the third row, with an extra seat reserved for Abigail's birth mother, but to no one's great surprise, the poor woman didn't show up. I know that sounds terrible, but I'd stopped blaming her a long time ago. Vicky's been teaching us all about the destructive powers of addiction, and I've learned how hard it is for anyone to make a full recovery. It's not clear if Abigail and her mother will ever have much of a future together, but after everything Tammy and I sacrificed for the kid, there was no way we could let her go back into the system. So my sister filed for adoption last year and signed all the paperwork on New Year's Eve. I wanted to co-sign the documents, but Pennsylvania won't allow a brother and sister to share custody, so legally I had to settle for being Uncle Frank. But I still made a point of seeing Abigail every day. I put myself in charge of all her after-school and weekend childcare, so my sister can get a break now and then. And when Abigail's drama teacher needed volunteers with strong backs to help wheel the sets, I was the first person to raise my hand. Opening night was a huge success. At the end of the show, the whole cast got a standing ovation, and everyone called for the stage crew to come out and take a bow. I was busy dragging a giant papier-mâché log into the wings, where none of the other kids would trip over it, so I missed the curtain call. But later I found Abigail backstage, and together we went outside to the school parking lot, where the teachers and parents had organized a reception. It was the first warm night of the year, and all the kids were reveling in the spring temperatures, running around the blacktop without jackets or gloves, fueled by sugar from all the homemade cookies and cupcakes and brownies. There was a very long line for hand-dipped ice cream cones, but Abigail and I resolved to wait in it, and she passed the time by sharing new jokes she'd learned at math club. Don't start a conversation with pie, because it will just go on forever. The best way to keep warm in a freezer is to find a corner, because they're always 90 degrees. And you should never call someone average, because it's actually mean. I couldn't even understand this last one, so Abigail had to stop and explain it to me. As soon as she had her ice cream, she made the mistake of running away, and a large scoop of chocolate chip rolled off her cone and hit the asphalt with a sickening splat. I reached for her empty cone and said, "Take mine. Trade with me." Abigail refused. She said it wouldn't be fair. "Come on. I want to switch," I told her. "The cone's my favorite part anyway." It took a little more cajoling, but I got her to swap, and then she carried my ice cream very carefully across the parking lot to join her friends. Vicky saw what had happened and came walking over.
The cone's your favorite part? Seriously?
I shrugged and showed her that Abigail's cone wasn't completely empty. There was still a fair amount of chocolate chip ice cream packed into the bottom. This is plenty for me, I told her. It's just the right amount. We had a nice time talking to all the other parents and watching the kids celebrate. After Abigail finished her ice cream, she and the other spoons and forks treated the crowd to an encore performance of Be Our Guest. They linked their arms and kicked their legs like rockettes and shrieked the lyrics without a shred of self-consciousness. Just before the reception ended, I was approached by the school's principal, the only man who'd come to the show dressed in a suit and tie. I knew a lot of the parents disliked him. Some of these people were always finding flaws with the teachers and the curriculum and the facilities and even the quality of the hot lunches, but I thought he did a nice job. I want to thank you for volunteering tonight, he said. You're Abigail's father, right? I've learned it's important to be clear with school administrators in case there's ever some kind of medical emergency. Actually, I'm her uncle. Aren't you Frank Zatowski? Yes, but Tammy Zatowski is my sister. We're not married. Tammy was across the playground in conversation with a gaggle of moms, and I pointed her out. She adopted Abigail last year. He seemed embarrassed and apologized for the misunderstanding. I could tell he was used to dealing with parents who were a lot more sensitive, and I assured him it was fine. Abigail loves your school. All her teachers have been fantastic. I wasn't sure the principal heard my compliment. He still seemed hung up on his mistake. Can I show you something? He asked. If you can spare a minute. Vicky and I followed him across the parking lot, inside the building, and up a flight of stairs to a darkened hallway full of classrooms. We stopped at a bulletin board that was covered with photographs and short essays about famous people. There was number one songwriter Beyoncé and number one quarterback Jalen Hurts and number one magician Shin Lim. The principal explained that the fifth graders were writing biographies of their heroes and sheroes, men and women who inspire us to do great things. Then he directed my attention to a photo of myself posing in a canoe and an essay titled Number One Dad, Frank Zatowski. This is why I got confused, he explained. I didn't have my reading glasses, so I had to squint to make out the text. Here are some fun facts about my father. He was a soldier in the United States Army. He fought in the Gulf War. He worked for UPS and drove over 1 million miles to deliver the stuff you need. He is good at canoeing, making grilled cheese, and getting the bugs out of my room. And he is good at taking care of me. If Abigail's confused about the relationship, we can schedule a sit-down with our head of counseling. She's very good at leading delicate conversations. Would you like her to give you a call? I didn't answer, because I was afraid my voice might break. I tried to gesture that there was a tiny piece of cone stuck in my throat, and fortunately Vicky came to my rescue.
Frank's okay with this, she said. He can talk to Abigail himself and let her know it's all right.
The principal looked relieved, another crisis averted, and said he needed to return to the reception. But he encouraged us to stick around and read the entire essay. It's one of the better ones. She got an A+. 9. FCI Corbettsville is a minimum security correctional facility near Binghamton, New York, about a 2-hour drive from my house. It's a new facility, less than 5 years old, designed to house nonviolent offenders. Instead of cells with bars, the inmates share spaces that resemble college dorm rooms. Everyone gets a window with a view. There are various jobs that pay 60 cents an hour, plus weekly classes in gardening, baking, cosmetology, finance, web design, and creative writing. It's not nearly as nice as FPC Alderson in West Virginia, a.k.a. Camp Cupcake, where Martha Stewart famously served 5 months after lying to federal investigators. But it's reportedly cleaner and safer than nearly any other federal prison in the United States. And this fact helps me sleep at night. Visiting hours started at 8:30, but by 7 o'clock I was parked in a long line of cars outside the gates, because all the internet forums advised me to show up early. Once inside, I showed my driver's license to a pair of corrections officers, and then a beautiful black lab came trotting over to sniff my Jeep for drugs. I greeted the dog with a friendly hello, and an officer immediately reprimanded me. "Don't distract the animal," he said. "She's working." Once inside the prison, I waited in more lines. An officer surveyed my clothes and decided they met the appropriate standards. No hats, no offensive t-shirts, and above all, no orange, the color worn by inmates. Then I walked through a metal detector and raised my hands over my head so I could be lightly frisked. I was surprised by the professionalism of the staff. Movies and TV shows had prepared me for the worst, but the officers were unfailingly polite. They said yes, sir, and no, sir, and thank you, sir. I wondered if they recognized my name, if they knew the details of my daughter's story, and now they were giving me some kind of preferential treatment. But from what I could gather, they were offering the same courtesies to everyone. After about an hour of waiting, I finally arrived at the desk marked registration. I presented my driver's license and visitation slip to a pair of officers seated behind a plexiglass window. They were both about my age, and they had the easy, familiar rapport of an old married couple, or just two employees who had been working at the same job for a long, long time. The man keyed my information into his computer while his partner compared the photo on my license to my real-life face. Then she must have noticed my date of birth because she smiled and said, "Happy birthday." "Thank you." I expected her to follow the comment with some kind of snarky joke, but she was being sincere. She acted like visiting a prison on your birthday was a perfectly normal thing to do. And for many of the parents waiting in line with me, I suppose it was. I felt like I was back in Osprey Cove all over again, back in another strange new world filled with unfamiliar customs and social cues. The man clicked a few buttons on his keyboard, then sighed and shook his head. "I'm sorry, Mr. Zatowski, but I don't see your name on her list." I was prepared for this moment. I knew most prisons in the United States required inmates to draft a list of pre-approved people for visitation days. Family, friends, attorneys, clergy. You can't just wander in off the street and visit the inmate of your choice, which is exactly what I was trying to do. "I did the forms online," I told him.
"Right. I see your security clearances, but Margaret needs to add you to her list, so we know she actually wants to visit with you."
He shrugged, suggesting that nothing else could be done.
"You gotta straighten it out with her and come back. Mondays, Wednesdays, or Saturdays, 8:30 to 3.
He pushed my driver's license back across the counter, but I refused to pick it up. I'd seen enough Reddit discussions on FCI Corbettsville to know the officers were considered decent and flexible and sometimes acknowledge that you're an actual human being. "I'm sorry for the mix-up. This is my first time."
"Rules are on the website."
And I woke up at 4:30 to beat the traffic. I drove all the way from Stroudsburg.
"Tell Margaret she needs to visit the warden's office and add your name to her list, and then next time you won't have any problems. I guarantee it."
He was already looking over my shoulder to the next person in line, but I made one last push. "I understand, but I've been waiting here since 7 o'clock. Is there anything we can do today?"
"No, sir."
"Could you call her room? Tell her I'm here?"
"The inmates don't have telephones. I'm sorry, but if you're not on her list, you're not on her list."
His partner seemed poised to disagree. She opened her mouth like she was about to offer a solution, so I shifted my focus to her. There's no other family to visit. It's just me. Is there any way you can help? She checked her wristwatch, a digital Timex, almost exactly like mine.
At this hour, all the women are in the yard for morning exercise. I'll see if I can find her.
Then she pushed herself to a standing position and told her partner to seat me at a table. He shook his head. He seemed amused by her willingness to do more than the bare minimum her job description required, then proceeded to read my instructions. Walk directly to table 18 and sit down. Do not attempt to sit at any other table. Do not converse or gesture to any of the other inmates or visitors. If you need to visit a restroom, raise your hand and ask the guard. If you want to make a purchase from the vending machines, raise your hand and ask the guard. You are allowed to respectfully embrace the inmate at the start and end of your visit, but all other physical contact is forbidden. Do you understand all the rules I've just outlined? Yes, I do. Doors on your right. Have a nice day. I stepped inside the visitation room, which had bright, cheerful colors and large windows admitting lots of natural light. It reminded me of the cafeteria at Holy Redeemer Hospital. There were vending machines dispensing everything from sodas and coffee to chips and even cold sandwiches. As I crossed the room to the table marked 18, I glanced at the other visitors, trying to discern all the various relationships on display. Inmate and spouse, inmate and child, inmate and attorney.
Just 7 more months, honey,
I heard one woman saying.
In 7 more months, all this will be over, and you'll be back home where you belong.
Elsewhere in the room, a baby was crying, and a surprising number of people had bowed their heads to pray together, in English and Spanish and languages I didn't recognize. I sat down at table 18. There was a large TV playing the Today Show with the volume muted and the subtitles on. Al Roker was interviewing a Second World War veteran who had found late in life fame as a TikTok celebrity, giving out life wisdom.
I don't think children are meant to be molded, he was saying. I think they're people waiting to be unfolded.
There were a couple of digital clocks spaced around the room to help visitors keep track of the time, but none of the clocks were in sync. One said 10:05, another said 10:06, and another said 10:03. But according to the Today Show, the actual time was 10:19. As I waited, the broadcast cut to a commercial with Chris Pratt and Aubrey Plaza promoting the Chrysler Reactor with the new and improved Miracle Battery Infinity. Despite all the controversy of the past year, capacity was on track to have another year of record sales. Customers didn't seem to care that the FBI had launched 4 simultaneous raids of Osprey Cove, the apartment at Beacon Tower, the Gardner's home in Cambridge, and Capacity's research headquarters. A team of special agents had arrested Errol, Catherine, Jerry, and Maggie. But, of course, my daughter was the only one serving any time. 3 to 5 years for conspiracy to obstruct justice and being an accessory to murder after the fact. Catherine Gardner was receiving treatment at a beachside rehab center in West Palm Beach, while Errol and Jerry remained free on millions of dollars in bail, filing appeal after appeal and using every last loophole available to the 0.001%. I didn't expect they would ever be properly punished, but I took some comfort in knowing that Dawn Taggart's body had been recovered from the bottom of Lake Wyndham, so her mother and uncle could finally lay her to rest. Better still, Hujo was promptly apprehended and extradited back to Kinshasa, the capital of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where he was awaiting trial for scores of human rights violations. Many speculated that he would be the first Congolese prisoner sentenced to death since 2007, but I was trying not to get my hopes up.
Eventually, the woman from registration entered the visitation area to find me. Her face was somber. She looked like a surgeon emerging from the ER to deliver some bad news.
I found Margaret in the exercise yard, and I told her you were waiting here. But she's decided she isn't going to come see you.
I felt bad for putting her in the middle of an awkward situation. I stood up and said, "Thank you for trying."
"One thing you could do is write her a letter," she offered. "Tell her what you're feeling on paper. Let her know you're interested in supporting her."
She was trying to be helpful, which I appreciated, so I didn't mention all the letters I'd already sent over the past few months, or the cards for her birthday and Christmas and just because. Always with a personal note, but never any pocket money, because the prison wouldn't allow cash by mail.
"I've met a lot of parents in your situation," the woman continued. "So don't leave here feeling like you're alone, okay? Because you're not the only one."
I left the building and walked out into the sunshine. It was still early, a beautiful, clear morning, and suddenly I had my whole day ahead of me. Vicky had planned a special dinner for later in the evening, and she'd invited a couple of my friends from UPS. Plus, Tammy and Abigail would be there, and after dinner I was sure we'd play charades or Pictionary or some other party game, because that's how we always celebrated our birthdays together. I knew I was fortunate to have so many wonderful people in my life, but I also knew at some point I would look around the dinner table and remember who was missing. I crossed the parking lot and unlocked the door to my Jeep, then turned to take one last look at the prison. It was an imposing concrete building with three levels of cells, and a window in a stairwell allowed a glimpse inside the facility. I could see dozens of female inmates in orange jumpsuits ascending the stairs, moving in an orderly single-file line. And I noticed something peculiar. Nearly every single woman turned to glance outside, to steal a quick look at the world beyond their walls. They were all different ages and races, but they all shared that same impulse. Most looked to the horizon, toward Route 81, way off in the distance. But every so often, an inmate locked eyes with me, checking to see if I was someone she knew.
"Excuse me, sir."
A corrections officer was walking toward me, a young woman about my daughter's age, dressed in a blue collared shirt, a black necktie, and a black hat.
"Have you finished your visit?"
"Yes."
"Then I need you to exit the parking lot. We have another group of visitors coming at 11, and they're going to need parking spaces, so they can go inside and see their loved ones."
My wristwatch said it was only 10:32, but evidently this kid was the law and order type. I liked that she took the extra time to explain the rules to me. She was tough, but fair. Someone had raised her right. I apologized, opened the door to my Jeep, and got inside. Then I looked back at the window. The inmates were still filing past, all returning to their cells, I guessed, after a session of morning exercise. I'd already counted some 40 women, and there were only 100 or so in the entire facility. I got out of my Jeep and called to the guard.
"Excuse me, officer? Could I ask a favor?"
She stopped and turned around.
"Can I stay 5 more minutes?
We hope you've enjoyed this production of The Last One at the Wedding by Jason Rakulik, read by John Perhala, a Macmillan Audio production for Flatiron Books. This title was produced by Steve Wagner. Post-production by Tim Franklin. Text copyright 2024 by Jason Rakulik. Production copyright 2024 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
For more information about Macmillan audiobooks, please visit macmillanaudio.com.